This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. These weeks on this program, we're featuring important American composers, alternating weeks with great instrumentalists, conductors, and singers. This week is a composer week, and we'll chat with Elena Rohr. Born in Michigan, Upper State Michigan, with a quirky, fun family music history, she studied at Michigan with William Bolcom and Juilliard with Vincent Persichetti. She dabbled in modern dance and Javanese gamelan, and in 1991 began teaching at MIT in Cambridge, where she still is, winning awards and recognition such as being a Guggenheim Fellow. Her music over the decades has built a large pool of champions, from the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, she was their first composer in residence, to Julian Wachner at Trinity Wall Street, to the Cypress String Quartet. They are featured in a new 2-CD set of my guests' 6, to date, string quartets, released on the AV label. That's them performing the third movement from the 4-movement string quartet number 3, this movement titled How She Danced, capturing the innocent joy of the composer's toddler daughter dancing across the kitchen floor. My guest draws inspiration from many sources, but always some source, seeing music as a narrative, be it everyday life, famous people, famous other music, places, myths, literature, you name it. It goes along with her voracious appetite to read as much as she can. I caught up with her a few months back at her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Here with composer Elena Rohr. Good to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you, Dave.
So with the release of this AV 2-CD set of your 6 string quartets, if we were back in days of record stores and CD shops and all the rest of that, it would be on the shelf and it would be the same type of packaging, the same content, being 6 string quartets by a single composer, as all 6 Bartok quartets. Or it would be the same packaging as the Beethoven Opus 18 quartets, 6 quartets, 2 CDs. I'm just curious, I just thought of that. Which one reflects where you're at with the string quartet, meaning the Bartoks were all we got from him,
Beethoven was the beginning of much more to come. So just curious.
So I'll tell you a story, which isn't going to answer your question. But then I'll answer. You can ask the question
That's
again.
Fine.
So the story is my dad in 1958 or something got a reel-to-reel tape recorder kit in the mail. And he built his own reel-to-reel tape recorder thing. And with the kit came all the Beethoven and Bartok string quartets. Reel-to-reel, okay? So I grew up, I was born after he built it. And I grew up listening to them. He just listened to them one after another, and in just like one after another, all mixed up. So they were the same to me, you know? And so the rule at my house was that I could go and listen to the music, but I couldn't bother my dad because he was listening while he was doing his math. He's a mathematician.
Right.
So I go and I just sit on the floor, 4 or 5 years old, listen to the music. Finally, one day, I got up the courage and I said, Dad, and actually I said Papa because that's what I called him. Papa, what is this? And he said, Bella Bartok. And I said, oh, Bella, she's a girl. So for me, Bella Bartok and Beethoven string quartets, which you just happened to bring up, are the girl composers that I grew up on. But anyway, I do.
Leonora and Bella.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I do expect to write more. I'm working on maybe getting a commission for the next one. So
okay.
I'll write more.
So there are going to be more.
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, some composers approach the quartet. It's such an intimate form for so many composers that they do X number and they say, you know, I either got to stop or, you know, I just was curious.
I'll probably write. I don't know if I'll write as many as Beethoven, but I'm going to write some more.
Well, it's interesting with the string quartets because it's kind of a path into your compositions as a whole. But the quartets, you give each one the title, the academic title, string quartet number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
However, past that, you go into the movements. Then you start to see by title, by name, or how their quartets are laid out, your inspiration, your energy source for whatever quartet it is, which also relates to how you compose other pieces. And some of that can be specific pieces of music, specific composers. It can be styles of other music cultures, literature, poetry, stories. One quartet's even devoted to tracing out an entire novel. Or even a movement like the one about your daughter dancing in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's a need when you compose to find some kind of energy source outside to sort of move channel along.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I kind of grew up in the time period when I went to school when music as narrative was discouraged. But it is the way I think. You know, for me, music is narrative. It just always has been. It's the way I listen. It's the way I write. It's the way I work. So I always have a story, even when I'm trying to be sort of abstract, even when it sounds more abstract. There's always an internal, maybe it's a private story that I have, but there's always a story, and it's a narrative form for me. So every piece I've ever written has an outside source of some kind.
There's a difference between narrative and programmatic music, is what I hear. I don't get that from parts. I mean, but it's not, this is the waterfall and this is the thunderclap and all the rest of this stuff.
Right, but like there's a kind of abstract music that has to do with being about itself or being about sound or being about form in a kind of more abstract way, but that's just not the way I think.
Yeah.
So I never embraced that idea.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is the string quartet number one doesn't have, you know, allegro or that. It doesn't have tempo markings. So in order for you to proceed on that piece of music, a quartet, a piece for choral, or orchestral piece, whatever, do you get it? I mean, is it a priori or is it?
Oh, they go hand in hand.
They go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I get a sound. Even my fifth quartet, the Bel Canto, based on Ann Patchett's novel.
Yeah.
It was a commission. I think that was the one that was probably the most I had the programmatic or whatever idea before I started writing. But even that piece, I still was playing around with some sounds before I committed to the idea. And usually I have a sound, and the sound suggests a sort of character or a feeling or some kind of maybe scenery. And then that sort of propels itself into the next step, which is the idea suggests a sound, and then the sound suggests an idea, and they go along like that.
I mean, you don't have like a notebook of things either in your head or sketched out that says, I'm waiting for when this will fit type of thing. That doesn't...
It doesn't work that way. It happens as it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very organic.
Once again, turning to the 2-CD set of my guest Elena Ruhr's string quartets, her string quartet number 5, commissioned by and performed by the Cyprus Quartet, has 10 movements, all musically depicting Ann Patchett's 2001 best-selling novel, Bel Canto. This work deftly uses music by other composers, Puccini, Schubert, and Dvorak. The movement we'll hear is called Carmen Studies Grammar.
You just mentioned sitting on the floor growing up listening to these string quartets while your dad did math. I mean, your dad, you know, got you into like puzzles or just mind games of you know, form and things like that. We should say this place where you did this, you were in Upper Michigan.
Way up in the northern tippy top. Yes.
Beautiful country, however, far removed from any major metropolitan area. What else were you absorbing growing up? I mean, there had to be pop music like that just because of what...
Sure, yeah. So there was Beethoven and Bartok string quartets. There was my mother, who was a folk singer. So she was singing a lot of folk songs, you know, Pete Seeger, that kind of stuff. She had a whole book, and she used to sing for schools, that kind of stuff. My dad was a big band jazz piano player, so he used to play all the Gershwin tunes, stuff like that, and Oscar Peterson arrangements. My brothers were listening to Led Zeppelin. My other brother, who's Fritz, he's a little bit more outside of the box. He was listening to Morton Subotnick. So I was listening to all this kind of crazy different stuff. And I played in a rock band, and I played in the pep band. I did all kinds of different music. I played in a church. I did all kinds of different musical things.
When did you start composing? I mean, was that high school years?
I was 4 years old.
You're 4 when the first...
When I started writing little tunes down. Nothing, I wasn't Mozart. I was writing really dopey little things.
Yeah.
But I did have a notebook and I did write stuff down. And I owe that to my mother, who was my teacher, and just assumed that if you learned to read music, you'd learn to write it, because she just didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
She was a folk singer.
Yeah.
So she figured if you're going to learn how to read music, you had to learn how to write it down. You had to write your own stuff. And so I just started doing that. And I never stopped.
So when you went on for higher education, was it Michigan first?
Again,
Bill Bolcom is a great teacher for someone coming out of a mix like you, right?
Yeah, although I didn't study with Bill until I was a graduate student.
Okay, all right.
Just so you know.
But I mean, just teacher-wise, Bolcom, Persichetti, people like this, who were open to a composer who was bringing the luggage you were bringing with you, right? As far as the mix of what was in your head.
They were both great. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I studied with Persichetti actually at Juilliard before I studied with Bolcom.
Okay.
Persichetti was my mentor, I would say. Bolcom was a great teacher.
Right.
But Persichetti was the first person who really, I just felt like, just picked me up and, you know, put me in the right place, headed me in the right direction, so to speak.
I'll get this in now, just sort of get out of the way, but it's still a question to ask. So you're a woman composer. It seems like with your output and reading about you, I don't know, did you hit many obstacles? Did you hit many gender side paths because, or didn't you run into much of that?
Oh my.
Oh my, sorry, I opened up a Pandora's box.
I had some troubles.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Okay. I mean, when you were going to school, I mean, I guess the mentor would have been somebody like a Joan Tower or somebody like that.
I did meet Joan Tower when I was at Aspen. It was after my undergraduate years, and she was great, and it was really nice. And I knew Libby Larson a little bit, and she was a great role model. I loved Libby because she had children, and I wanted to have children, and that was actually sort of an issue to be a woman, to be a composer, to be a mom, you know?
It's like a, well, the obstacles just... taking you seriously, or...
Oh, taking you seriously. There was a lot of pressure to write music like a guy. So if I wrote music that was too soft or sweet or something, I would get a lot of flack. I did.
Yeah.
And then there was a little of the Me Too kind of stuff. I had a couple of professors who, you know, made passes at me. You know, that's disheartening because it's not just as they're making passes at you, which, you know, I kind of brushed them off, but you brush somebody like that off and who knows what the result is going to be, you know?
You're looking to them for a recommendation or
something
like that.
It was hard. It was tricky.
It's, I mean, you know, we're getting there, but if you even just look at the success women composers have in the last few years, just look at the Pulitzer Prize, for gosh sakes, you know? I mean, we hope we're all coming out of it and there's not, there won't have to be concerts of highlighting women composers, just they're highlighting composers, you know, type of thing.
From a recording of chamber music by my guest, also on the Avi label, this is a work from 2009 called Adrienne and Amy, in honor of the trailblazing American composer Amy Beach and her biographer, Adrienne Freed, a work based on a motive from Beach's A Hermit Thrush at Morn. We'll hear the second movement, The Hermit Thrush, leading into the first minute or so of the final movement, Professor in the Garden. Irina Mirsanu on violin, Sarah Bob on piano, music of my guest today, Elena Ruhr.
You've taught at MIT, over 25 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why there, and what has that done to shape you as a composer over all these years?
Oh, that's a big question. Because it has been 25 years, yeah. More than 25. I got the job just because I am married and my husband had a job here in Boston and I was very committed to staying here and having a child and living in Boston and having a stable family life. And so once he's at Harvard and once I got the job at MIT, we were just like really committed to keeping that, working that out. There's a couple things about MIT, you know, really a lot of things. One is that they've supported my work. So I have a lot of CDs that I've produced and MIT has supported my production of those CDs. So, you know, I mean, they don't pay for everything that gets produced, but they'll pay for the final little thing that has to be done, yeah. Or whatever. So that's really helpful. John Harbison at MIT has been super supportive and great. It helped me a lot. And the whole faculty is wonderful there. But there's another thing which happened, which is that because MIT doesn't have a real music composition major, in fact, what I teach is tonal theory.
Okay.
So I teach kids how to write string quartets in the style of Mozart and Beethoven, and that's what I do. And so it has had this profound effect on the way I think about writing string quartets,
yeah.
You know, because I feel really deeply connected to the literature because I talk about it all the time. And, you know, there are times I thought, oh, this is kind of a bad thing because maybe it's, you know, making me more conservative or whatever, but it's so right for me to do it and I feel so good about it that I think it must be a good thing, you know.
The fourth quartet is the one that the Cypress commissioned, some project they had going, where you were supposed to take C major quartet of Mozart, the one that's known as the Dissonance, mm-hmm. and then the, one of the Opus 59s of Beethoven. So you must have like been, yeah, when that came along, it's like perfect.
Well, you know, it's really funny because I was like, oh no, I like Opus 59 number one a little bit better, you know. Maybe can we do this other Mozart one? We sort of had that, and they were like, no, it has to be these quartets. You have to respond to these. And then I just dove in and I, you know, I had a great time with it. And it did make a lot of sense. And MIT brought the Cypresses out here to play it and play it with the Mozart and the Beethoven to do the concert. And it was great.
Because they're MIT students, and some of our listeners might think, MIT music, you know, I mean, does that make the teaching a little bit different? You're not doing with conservatory kids who are on the track and are never going to diverge from it or something.
The kids are super, super smart.
Yeah.
I've been told that teaching harmony is a lot like chemical engineering. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I've been told, that the way notes sort of fit into each other, you know, like if you take a major scale and you divide it up into triads and the way the triads sort of fit with each other, or even if you study combinatoriality and the way the notes all sort of combine and stuff is very much like chemical engineering. I don't know if it's true. I just know that that's what the kids say. And they just pick it up so quickly, so that when I teach my first year harmony course, I'm not just teaching, you know, a couple of chord progressions and some Bach chorales. They compose string quartets, and the only prerequisite, they can read music before they take it. By the time they're done, they write these little string quartets that sound like, well, Salieri maybe, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they're pretty good, yeah. You know, and they're completely composed and they're really fast and they're really good at it. So, but they don't major in music mostly. Once in a while we get a major.
Right.
But then they do goofy things, like every semester I get somebody writing a computer program that does the homework.
Something a conservatory professor does not have to worry.
No.
Their oboe player's not going to develop something that'll do their playing for them.
I think writing the program's a lot harder than doing the homework.
Here are the final minutes of a work by my guest Elena Rohr for clarinet, cello, and piano, performed by Benjamin Seltzer, Alexi Gonzalez, and Hengjing Park, a work inspired by a poem composed by my guest's daughter when she was 10, called Blackberries. Thank you.
Another facet to your writing is a deep love of poetry, literature. We talked about how that can spur your influence and get you going. How do texts get on your radar? How do you then filter them down that they're going to be set? I mean, how does that whole process work?
I mean, I can just give you examples of how I get into texts because it's different for every piece I write. So I did Louise Glück because I was introduced to her through a friend who's a poet, a friend of Alan Pearson's.
Oh, yeah.
Garth, and he's a great writer. Anyway, Garth was a big fan of Louise Glück's, and so I started reading Louise Glück, and then I met Louise Glück. I was introduced by Garth at a party, and I told her I was a huge fan of hers, and that I wanted to write an opera based on her work, and then she was like, well, I don't write commissions, but here's my book that's not published yet. And I read it, and I was just so thrilled. So that was that. I have another friend, Elizabeth Alexander. I'm having a piece done with her work in May this year. And I know her because I went to the Radcliffe Institute with her. I worked with a couple of librettists who I know from one way or another. Sometimes they contact me. I found Madison Smart Bell and Elizabeth Spires, who wrote my opera, Toussaint, Before the Spirits, because I was reading his book. Sometimes I contact people. Sometimes they contact me. Sometimes it's serendipitous. But it's personal. A lot of my connections with writers are personal. Even like Ann Patchett, I read her book long before I got to know her, but I did get her sort of permission and became sort of email pals with her before I did it. So the personal connection is really important to me.
Is setting text, I mean, some composers shy away from setting text. We talked about Trump Tower before. I mean, what are concerns in your language, dramatic end? If it's a choral work, do you worry about its difficulty so that it could be sung by a school amateur choir all the way up to professional choir? You worked with Roomful of Teeth, and that's about as far as you can peg the needle this way as far as a choral group redefining vocals. So I'm just curious, you know, how you approach those.
Yeah, I mean, I don't write for amateur musicians. I've learned that I think that what I do is easy, but it's not. So I just gave up on that. Especially because I don't write, my rhythm is a little different, you know, and that's really hard for amateurs to sort of pick up on. So I'm always writing for professional groups. For me, the language has a lot to do with the way the rhythm of the words works. It's kind of less about the sound of the words in the sense of consonants and vowels, but more about just the rhythm of how it lays out. And it either speaks to me or it doesn't. Louise Glück is really just spoke to me instantly. Langston Hughes is an obvious choice just because he actually had songs in his head, I know, when he was writing his poetry. So yeah, it's the rhythm of the words is what speaks to me. And the rhythms of the text leads to, usually is the first thing that I start with. I actually will memorize the poem or whatever text I'm working with, write down the rhythmic outline of that text, and then slowly pitch it. So it always starts with the rhythm of it.
Yeah, it's interesting, the piece you did about Eve, you actually approached Genesis like a prose text of poetry rather than getting all the theological drippings out of it, you know?
Yeah.
It's so...
Well, yeah. That's my personal way of reading that material. Right. So what can I say?
The higher form of that drama, opera, Averno is really like an oratorio type of thing, characters, but, you know, not stage. Where are you at with that? Again, I've had so many composers on over this show who have, it's a love-hate thing with opera. They've either had such a horrible experience. You mentioned John Harbison before years ago when I had him. I was just like, oh, it was a nightmare, you know. And some just do it and they just gravitate to it. And it seems to, it eats up a lot of your time. I mean, where does it fit in? You think it'll be more of your output as it goes?
Yeah, I'm working towards writing more opera.
Yeah,
it's definitely the right thing for me. I'm working on an opera with Cerise Jacobs now. She's the librettist for Madame Whitesnake. And so I'm writing that right now. I was just writing it before you walked in the door. And I wrote a couple of other operas that you don't know about because they're not recorded. And I have had the experience of writing, like the Cassandra in the Temples was for Roomful of Teeth, and it got produced again, but it never got really, it never took off. It was an odd Fish. It was an a cappella opera. And I mean, I'm very proud of that piece. And I think it's kind of cool and neat, but it's like such a strange thing to have, you know, 8 solo voices do a whole opera, right? So that was kind of interesting. And I've had my moments where I've written an entire opera and it takes me 8 months mm-hmm. and it just gets one performance and it's gone, you mm-hmm. know, or two performances or whatever. And I know that about opera.
And you still want
And it. I still want to do it because mm-hmm. I love the imagination that it takes to sort of imagine the staging. I love, you know, you're directing the actors. Every word choice that you make is a inflection, timing or pitch wise. And right. it's really cool. It's really interesting. So I'll keep doing it. I've been writing this opera now. And what I do is I'll work on it. You know, I'll write 3 or 4 scenes and then I'll write a chamber music piece and then I'll write 3 more scenes and then I'll write another chamber music piece. And it's kind of like a little release because the chamber music is so much easier and faster.
So you can break your train of thought.
I kind of break my chain of thought. That's what I've been doing. So no, I love writing opera. I think it's fun.
Music of my guest Elena Ruhr setting the poems of Louise Glück from her Averno cantata using Glück's rewriting the story of Demeter, goddess of the earth, and her daughter Persephone, whose abduction Demeter avenges by making the earth barren. We'll hear the opening movement, The Night Migrations, and then the movement titled Omens. Soloists Marguerite Krull and Stefan Salters and the Trinity Choir Wall Street are led by Julian Wachner.
Before we turned the recorder on, we were telling you that you and I have a lot of people in common. And these people, the 4 I'm going to name, well, 3 in one group, have been either past Cadenza guests or we work with them on the Classical Network or we will be working with them. The first our listeners have been hearing for going on 7 years, and that's Julian Wachner, who's head of the music at Trinity Wall Street with the Bach at 1. It's a very popular program. Julian recorded your choral CD, but I guess I'm getting at the support that these people give you and how it relates to your career. I mean, Julian has been very supportive of your choral works, the works for voice, which has to be great. You know?
fabulous, fabulous. And Julian approached me, it must have been 20 years ago, more than that, 22 years ago, and said, write me something when he was at BU.
Yeah.
And then he kept me in his little, the back of his mind all those years.
His little
and then,
Rolodex.
Yeah. And then one day he calls me up and says, I want to do all your choral works. And I said, wow, are you really? Is this for real? Oh, I was so thrilled. And so thrilled with what happened, you know, with the CD and how it came out. And that was quite a ride. That was a hard thing to pull off because it's not just chorus, it's soloists and orchestra and whole hour of music. It was hard to pull that off, but we did it. I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, he's still interested in doing your works. I mean, like the second group I'm going to name here, the Cypress String Quartet, again, past Cadenza guests, but here's a quartet that, like many of the younger quartets, new music, integral part of what they program. Cypress, like some other quartets, say, we're going to really promote this composer. We really like this composer. Mm. So they did that with you, but in spades, because it's also turned into commissions. I mean, it's... Just to have a quartet like that, who's recording, in this case on Avi, but to be committed to you as a living composer. It's like,
oh, it's great. I mean, you know, they've broken up, and I'm very sad about that. But for a good 10 years there, I called them my band. I don't even know if they know that, but I just felt like anytime I wanted to write a quartet, I would have this amazing group of people to play it. And it did work out that way. They did commission 3 of my quartets.
Yeah.
But I'm still good friends with all of them, and so I'm writing them. I wrote a viola sonata for Ethan and a cello piece for Jennifer, and Cecily is touring with my violin piece, and Tom, I'm just keep bothering him. One of these days he'll play something. I think I have to write him a violin sonata. I'll have to go call him up. Yeah, no, I keep in touch with them, so that's really cool.
Once again, from the 2-CD set of my guest's string quartets, numbers 1 through 6, the closing movement from her first effort, string quartet number 1, 4 pieces, 4-string quartet, this named after the medieval dance, the estampie, performed by the Cypress Quartet, music of Elena Ruhr.
were mentioning rhythm in your compositions. You had studied some dance in your course or your career. I mentioned here Evan Zipporin, composer, performer, not only a big name with Bang on the Can All-Stars, but he's taught at MIT for a long time. And he started what is probably the preeminent gamelan orchestra at MIT. We've had them on the air. He's been past cadence, I guess. I mean, you've dabbled in that world as well. So I'm just, you're both colleagues at MIT. I'm just wondering if that crossing paths with how he's brought that Eastern music philosophy over here. But, you know.
Yeah, well, Evan is a good friend of mine. We're really good colleagues. And I love gamelan. He does Balinese gamelan.
Balinese gamelan.
And I did Javanese gamelan before I ever met him. Yeah. And it's actually really different. I mean, it's the same in a lot of ways, but it's very different sound. And to me, it's like a really different philosophy. So I have that different sort of take on all that stuff. I would never say that I was a world music person in the way that Evan is. Evan really is an expert in understanding world music, but I am a dabbler and I do listen to all those folkways recordings. I love those non-produced things because I like to hear what people do when they're just kind of hanging around. And, you know, once it gets produced, there's a whole layer of prejudice that gets put on it, you know? So I really like to just kind of get at the essence of what makes people musicians and what makes them tick. So in that way, I think Evan and I are kind of on the same page, but he's much more of an expert than I am.
Yeah, just the different influences that can come into your works, because you can hear it in a number of your works. Last one is, hopefully our listeners will hear much more from him. He passed Cadenza guest last year, the founder and director of the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, BMOP for short, Gil Rose. You were their first composer in residence. And you said how you put roots down in Boston, you guys are here. So it was, I guess that was a real boost to have a young orchestra focused on new music like that want to come to you as their composer in residence.
It was huge. That was a huge, huge thing. I remember being kind of nervous when I auditioned for the job.
You had auditioned for the job?
Yeah, they interviewed a bunch of us and we all came in and we were one after another in a room, you know, like, and I don't know who else was being talked to, but I just know that I had to go and talk to them and that there were a couple of us. And so it was an audition, but I remember Gil and I just kind of clicking, you know what I mean? I think especially in the way that we think about how we connect to audiences, because Gil's philosophy, you know, at the time that Gil came to Boston, Boston was very controlled by universities in terms of the philosophy and the aesthetic of the new music groups in town. Right. And they seemed to be little sort of offshoots of Harvard or offshoots of Brandeis or offshoots of MIT. But Gil was sort of this independent person who was really had an open mind about what kind of new music was good new music.
Right.
And I felt the same way. And when I first moved here, I was a little frustrated by that sort of closed down atmosphere. And meeting Gil was just like a breath of fresh air. It was so great to have this. Because I remember one of the first concerts I did with him as composer in residence was a film music concert. It was all film music. And it was just like, oh, this is great. I love this stuff. You know, it was just such a different kind of idea than what we'd had.
His group, along with so many others in some major U.S. cities, there's this whole springing up of these ensembles who either devote themselves entirely to new music or have a nice balance going on. I mean, it's really, really healthy. It's amazing
what
the scene is right now.
There's this group in Washington called the New Orchestra of Washington. Have you heard of them?
The New Orchestra, I've heard of them.
Shout out to them because they're younger than BMOP, but I remember when they were just starting out and I was telling them the BMOP model. And I think maybe they kind of used it a little bit, but they do a kind of half and half commissions and old stuff. But they're great. They're just
fantastic. Broadcast every other month the programs with Post Classical Ensemble, which is based in Washington D.C. Same thing, type themed programs. Joe Horowitz, who had so much success with Brooklyn Phil sort of programs, but that'll too. They'll go into areas and composers and music which just need more light on them, be they new or passed on. That's all very healthy stuff.
My guest was the first composer in residence for the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. Here they are, under the direction of their music director, Gil Rose, in the closing minutes of my guest today, Elena Ruhr's 1995 Shimmer.
I've sort of saved this to almost last. There's this little mantra, and I think as our listeners have heard your music in this program and heard you talk, the surface is simple, the structure complex.
Yeah.
It's a great slogan that you need to like put on something.
Put on a t-shirt, or put it on my hat, wear a little hat.
So, I mean, in that, when people hear your music, they get a lot of it. A high percentage of it can speak to them, whether melodically, whether harmonically, even they pick up some of the structure things. But what's happening underneath, you're right, is pretty darn complex. It's your statement. I just wonder if you could just talk about it a little bit, expound on it a bit.
Well, it's something that's followed me around since I was probably 25, 24 years old. I was in graduate school, and you know, you were supposed to sort of figure out your place in the world as a graduate student. You get older, you kind of just do whatever you want, you know, but in school you have to kind of figure that out. And I was so tired of the debate over, at the time, the sort of serialist and post-serial kind of complexity against minimalism and its simplicity. And I was so tired of that debate because it seemed like it was so artificial and wrong, because it seemed like the music that I love was simple on the surface and complex underneath. You know, you think about great Mozart, you think about Beethoven, you think about any of these great musicians, it happens. You think about it in great gamelan music, there's something like that going on, right? You think about it in a great political speech, right? And the way that great politicians will give you a Jesse Jackson, or will give you a simple metaphor, but underneath it is the whole political current that defines that. I mean, that seems to me like it's, yes, that's what it should be for everybody. It's not just me. But anyway, yeah, that's, you know, I mean, maybe it's too pat, but it is the thing that drives me.
Well, I think that's interesting about the statement from my standpoint is, if you take the statement backwards, most modern composers, in a great part of the latter part of the 20th century, strove for complexity. The processes pushed them there. And you want your music to be complex, yet you also want the other end of the first part of that sentence. I mean, as you've composed over the years certain pieces, do you find yourself trying to find that balancing line? Or does it just kind of come naturally to you?
Oh, I am always walking that line. Yeah. I was just working today on a little dance between a robot and a goddess.
And, picture that in your head for a second.
Yeah, okay. Picture that, the robot and the goddess. It's going to be great. You know, I want it to be simple and I want it to be complicated. And sometimes I write something and it's just too simple and I just throw it away. And sometimes I write it and it's too complicated and I throw it away. Mm-hmm. So I really do. It's like a little line I'm walking along. Yeah,
struggle.
I'm like, yeah, how do I make this work both ways?
Yeah.
And it has to pass the test.
And it's probably one of the hardest things a composer who wants to write like you do can, that's the battle you fight within to stick to. Well, okay, you mentioned a couple opera. I mean, I always ask composers because some things they're either superstitious or they can't, but I mean, can you tease us with anything that's coming, what's coming up or coming out or anything? Or
sure. Okay. So I think it's not a secret that I'm writing a piece called Cosmic Cowboy with Cerise Jacobs as their librettist, and it's the White Snakes Productions, which is her opera production group. You know, she does these amazing, cool productions that are really cool. I don't know, this is going to have some kind of really interesting production, but it's about the origin of humans, and then humans are created, and the gods create humans, and then humans create robots, and robots go out into space, and that's how the goddess meets the robot.
And the cowboy comes in.
He's the robot, is the cosmic cowboy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, yeah, so he's got a personality, he's not just your average robot.
Oh. A Westworld thrown in there.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's pretty wacky and weird, but I think it'll be fun. And then I've got another piece I'm kind of excited about that's clarinet quintet. It's for string quartet and clarinet. I just found out today that this is official. It's commissioned by John Manassi and the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival. It won't be out until next summer, so it's still a year and a half. But I already know it's called Icarus, and it's a program music piece. So
about the myth?
About the myth, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, great. Keep the stuff coming. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. First is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to talk to. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops in your head?
Weird but true, Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever set Virginia Woolf?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't plan to either.
Oh, all right.
She just, you know, because I love to read and I read like in crazy amount. And reading To the Lighthouse when I was 23 years old was like an epiphany for me.
Okay.
She had some, you know, troubles, and I would like to kind of get into her head and see what it was. What was going
You're the
on.
First person in the years of Cadenza to pick Virginia Woolf. I've had authors and poets and writers before, but you're the first one.
I think she would be a kind of a gnarly person to talk
yeah,
to.
Yeah, that should be a really pleasant conversation, but it's on you.
I'm really curious, though.
Final question is, everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. What do you do when you have to get away, respite, relaxation, enjoyment, but can you need to pull yourself away? What do you do?
Oh, I read.
You read?
I read like crazy.
Okay.
Yeah, I read 2 or 3 hours a day.
But is your mind going with the reading? Is there a channel as you read saying possibility, or are you just reading for
fun? No, I'm just reading for fun.
Just reading
just for fun. And
you
I read.
Shut that off.
I read, you know, I read great literature, but I also read mystery novels and sci-fi and all kinds of, you know, whatever, pulp fiction. I read everything. But I read 3 books a week, so I have to really plow through a lot of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you get all those reading awards as a kid in school?
No, no, for heaven's sakes. Nobody, I mean, I'll tell you, but, well, no, I'm telling everybody, but, no, I mean, it's not like, I mean, some people watch television, it's an addiction for
right.
me, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm addicted to reading, and I read almost anything. Well, I won't read a novel. If I'm starting to read a novel and I don't like it, I'll toss it out and pick up the next one, but, yeah.
Well, Elena Ruhr, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Composer Elena Ruhr. You can find out more about her at her website, Elena, E-L-E-N-A, Ruhr, R-U-E-H-R.org. The recordings of her choral works, chamber works, and the 6 string quartets are released on the AVI label. Check them out at AVI-records.com. I'll leave you with the closing minutes of the closing movement, appropriately marked finale, from the last, for now, until we get that 7th quartet available, string quartet from my guest, a work the Cyprus Quartet commissioned, and they are performing, the finale from the quartet number 6, music of my guest today, Elena Ruhr. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network at wwfm.org.